ॐ ज्ञानतिमिरन्नस्य ज्ञानञ्जनाशलाकाया चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः.
Welcome. Thanks for coming. It's kind of Silicon Valley. Today we're going to have chanting. Thank you. And also we'll have a discussion about awakening and increasing our receptivity based on the simple idea that everything in the universe is actually open to us. It's only we that close ourselves to the various gifts that are abundantly available based on the way we open ourselves to those gifts. So one of the ways in which the the great bhakti teachers and the scriptures teach bhakti recommend that one become more receptive to the gifts that are coming from Krishna at every second is through the process of sankirtan, or chanting the holy names. Because the chanting of divine names of God is purifying. Because the names are spiritual, and by contact with the names, by chanting them, we purify the mind, the senses, and that opens the channels so that we can become aware of the presence of Krishna at every moment, because as is mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita, he's there within the heart, and he's also present in our lives in various ways that we only become aware of when we're fully receptive. So advanced receptivity is needed, not ordinary receptivity. And the chanting also gives us a chance to express our heartfelt devotion. Everyone, every living entity, according to the Bhakti scriptures, has a sense of devotion, because it's our eternal nature to feel love and want to direct it towards someone. However, I direct it, as an old song in America that I think has been covered several times says, looking for love in all the wrong places. I direct that original love that I have for my divine source, which is perfectly reciprocated when I do, to various other entities and causes and so forth that then aren't able to reciprocate. So chanting of God's names and remembering that we're actually directing our devotion towards Him is a fulfilling experience in and of itself. So let's chant. Unless anybody has any questions about it before we start. So you're all blessed souls because you have an inclination for hearing. And I just read something in the 10th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam where I'm reading each morning. And it was a statement by one of our acharyas, Sanatana Goswami, who said that what to speak of people, he said that if anyone even has the slightest inclination to hear about Krishna in his pastimes, then such people are highly advanced in their liberated souls. What to speak of those who lean into it and have discerned that hearing is the gateway to success, that is hearing about Krishna. So I deeply appreciate your company here and everybody else who's joined us online to simply hear about Krishna. It's a rare thing. I think we're a small population in Silicon Valley here. But everyone's hearing something. But most of it is useless. This isn't. So tonight I'm going to start by reading some of the poetry, at least one poem written by Bhaktivinoda Thakur, in his section of the Sharanagati. This is his book called Sharanagati, and it's also combined with the Gitavali. Bhaktivinoda Thakur is just the greatest. I mean, everything that he wrote is devotionally moving and perfect. He wrote the Jiva Dharma and 99 other books, and he wrote hundreds, thousands of songs. They just flowed from his heart. And just by hearing them, just by studying them, one comes to understand what pure devotion is. So the Sharanagati is a very important work, because as most of you probably know, Sharanagati means the sixfold path of taking shelter of Krishna. Oftentimes people are confused by what to do when they have a sense that I should become Krishna conscious. What do I do next? And Bhaktivinoda Thakur, as an acharya and as other acharyas have done, lays out the path so that we know what to do next. Because there always is a next step. We may not be able to take the ultimate step, or we may not be able to take huge steps. We may not be able to take any step at all, but we may be interested in taking the step, so when we're ready, we know what it is. So, in describing the path of surrender, or of taking shelter, Sharanagati means that, that there are six items. One of them is to accept things that are favorable for devotional service. The second is to distance oneself from those things that are unfavorable. So, you know, those are things, they're just very practical. One could make a list. And if you need a little help on that list, you can look at the Nectar of Instruction, because there, Rupa Goswami has listed several items, six actually, that are favorable to devotional service, and six items that are unfavorable to devotional service. For instance, enthusiasm is favorable. Be enthusiastic. Entheos means, actually originally means divinely inspired from within. En means within, and theos means God. And of course, I've read verses that say, enthusiasm is auspicious wherever you see it. It's an expression of the soul. But especially when you give enthusiasm for devotional service, for devotional activities. And then there are five other items that you can read about. And then when you go into the unfavorable items, it starts with atyahara, which means, ati means extreme, and ahara means collecting or eating. So it means just getting absorbed in collecting things or eating way too much. You don't have to do that, or you should avoid doing that. Be careful. You can curb your tendency in that way. See, it's a practical. There are five others after each one. So in the Charanagati, one is observant of various things that are good for you, good for your devotional practice, and those things that are bad, and you try to adjust accordingly. If you're doing that, you're really on the path of taking shelter of Krishna. Then the next recommendation is that one see oneself as being maintained by Krishna. Of course, Krishna's energy is everywhere and within everything. And I know I've seen at different intervals in my life that, oh, actually it was Krishna all the time behind it. I know when both of my parents left, I experienced for myself that they were kind of masks, and behind that mask was Krishna. Where did they get their energy? They had very little to do with my being born in the world. I mean, it's a physiological thing that the body gets created and stuff, but they didn't know exactly how it happened either. And then as far as resources go, they're all coming from Krishna. So a devotee who develops this idea, mentality, that Krishna is maintaining me, he's my exclusive maintainer, is engaged in the process of Sharanagati, taking shelter of Krishna. And then Krishna is my protector. It's very similar to maintainer, but protector means that Mari Krishna Raki Ke, Raki Krishna Mari Ke. If Krishna wants to kill me, no one can protect me. And if Krishna wants to protect me, nobody can kill me. So then comes humility. Humility is in Bengali, also Sanskrit, called dainya. This dānya means utter humility or extreme humility. And it is actually, it's not only a practice, but it's also one of the features of bhakti. It's concomitant with bhakti. There's several concomitants that come with bhakti. One is dāya, or a sense of compassion towards other living beings, and also this sense of humility. And we'll talk a little bit about that tonight. And finally, in the sixfold path of Sharanagati, surrender to Krishna, giving one's being to Krishna, understanding that everything, not just all my possessions, but actually, and not just my body and mind, but actually my soul, I'm part and parcel of Krishna, I belong to Krishna. This sense of giving everything is called Atma Nivedana, sixfold. Any comments about those before I go on with the poem from Bhaktivinoda Thakur that gives a sense of what dānya or humility feels like coming from the heart of an advanced devotee? You want to feedback anything? Yes.
Hare Krishna. Today, I read an article up today about humility, and it was talking about how if we approach the scriptures with arrogance and thinking that we know what it's talking about instead of humility, and we're just trying to like mentally speculate about it, then we won't actually grow. We'll just kind of develop like a hard heart or get even further into this darkness. So I guess the question is, what if we like interacting with the material intellectually? Then how do we, and if there's no bhakti yet, then how do we engage with what it is that we're studying?
This is described in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. Siddhanta Bolaya Chitanakara Alash Iha Huite Krishna Lagi Sudradmanash. The author of Chaitanya Charitamrita, Krishna Kaviraj Goswami, is presenting many philosophical arguments to show how Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And then he says that one shouldn't be lazy when discussing these things, and that Siddhanta means to understand very clearly what something is. You know, when you're sharpening an axe, you have to hit it from both sides. So you'll find that throughout the Vedanta Sutra and many of the other literatures by the acharyas, there's a presentation, given a theory put forward, and then there's what's called the purvapaksha, or the antithesis. Means that the author himself, who's putting forward the argument, that will then give the opposite and argue against his own theory and say, yes, but you could say the opposite. And then he'll defeat that argument and come to the synthesis. And this is called the Siddhanta. So you have to hit the axe from both sides to make it sharp. And that's what this verse means. Siddhanta bolya chitta nakara alash. You shouldn't be lazy, alash, about sharpening the axe. So that's not something that will make you hard-hearted, but rather, iha hoite Krishna logi shudrid manash, shudrid. You become fixed when you understand intellectually that through good reason and argument why Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And Krishna says in the Gita, evam buddhi param buddhva samstab yatmanam atmana jahi shatram mahabaho kama rupam durasadam. At least you should understand with your intelligence of how not to get entangled in the material world, so that you can control the lower self by the higher self. Submissive hearing means to listen and appreciate the source, but you'll notice that the source is valid, that Arjuna asks a lot of questions. It's didactic. He's asking, you know, what about this? But you just said that, and what does this mean? And throughout the Bhagavatam, you'll find that Parikshit Maharaj is asking questions. When he asks questions, for instance, in the sixth canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, about how it is that living entities will be saved from hellish conditions of life in the material world, and Shukadeva Goswami then says, by performing karma kanda. And then his disciple Parikshit Maharaj said, Guru Maharaj, I think that that's not a very good answer. Because, I think that you're just presenting some answer, but it's not the whole answer. It's not the truth. You see, so he did it on purpose. Shukadeva Goswami presented a half answer or no answer at all, or the incorrect answer to test his disciples, see if how astute he was and how much he was listening. So this kind of listening and studying with one's intelligence is not prohibited. In fact, Prabhupada says one should study the philosophy thoroughly threadbare. Thoroughly threadbare. Say thoroughly threadbare. It's a nice phrase that he gave us. And you think of thoroughly threadbare. You know, with anything, they don't have mitts in cricket, do they? I guess if they have bats or something. I guess if you swing it at a ball enough time, it gets threadbare. You know, you just use it so many times, that sense is there that you've been over it hundreds, thousands of times. So it's very, very clear. And so that's okay. The submissive hearing means to understand that this is, you've concluded that there is a source for understanding the absolute truth. You're not questioning that. But within the process of hearing, there are clarification that maybe definitely will need to be made. Any other thoughts about that before I go on to the next part? Yes, Prabhu.
So, Maharaj, you are mentioning about the six limbs of Sharanagati, but in Bhagavad Bhagavatamrita, it is said like, you know, Danyata is actually encapsulating all other limbs as well.
That what?
Danyata, the humility aspect. Yes, yes. Because if you are humble, that you have all limbs of Sharanagati. But if you see this verse, you know, the Anukalyasa Sankalpa Patikalyasa Bhachanava, it seems like that the highest is Atmanivedana, because it comes after Danya. Means like you have actually given all of your, you know, aham, means like whatever you have given everything to Krishna. So how to understand this? Because in Vyad Bhagavatamrita, it only discusses about Danyata, and it says like this is Sharanagati, this is the surrender process. But it doesn't say much about, you know, Atmanivedana or other parts of Sharanagati.
Yeah, I'll go into that a little bit later about, as I mentioned in the beginning, there are concomitants to bhakti. The bhakti proper mentioned daya and also dainya. They're natural parts of bhakti. In fact, it says in the Bhagavatamrita that as one advances in devotional service, that one should also be advancing in dainya. And this will be, it's practically, the author says it's synonymous with bhakti. As usual, with any list of things, there are different ways of parsing it. There are lists of various items that can be looked at in different ways. In fact, in the Sankhya section of the Bhagavatam, it's not exactly related. This is just the idea of hermeneutics, how you're analyzing the information you're looking at. Krishna himself says in 11th canto, some sages say there are this many elements, some say they divide it like this, others say they divide it like that. And even in the discussion of the various stages of bhakti, starting adaushada, tata, sarasangata, bhajana, kriya, etc., which means that there's a progression of various stages dependent on the thickening of one's faith in Krishna. And those can also appear out of sequence. It's not that they have to be in an exact sequence and so forth. And there are other discussions, for instance, in the six symptoms of pure devotional service mentioned in the beginning of the nectar devotion. Those match up with various stages of bhakti, two, two, and two. So different ways of counting and looking at it. And maybe more will come out when I talk about how they're mixed together, I hope. Yes?
Can you reach God with the intellect?
Can you reach God with the intellect?
Well, you can get as far as understanding that he's inconceivable with the intellect. But after that, Brahma, who's the, you see, according to the Vaishnava theology, Brahma is the smartest being in the universe. He has four heads. So, and he read the Vedas three times. The first time he read them, he understood that it meant karma. Second time, he understood it meant jnana. Third time, he said, oh, it means bhakti. But in any case, because he's so smart, and it can be actually a disadvantage to be really smart, because then you think you have to figure everything out. And Brahma's like that too. And there's a story in the Srimad Bhagavatam where he tries to out mystic power Krishna, because he sees this little cowherd boy and he thinks, you know, how powerful can he be? So he exhibits his power mystically and steals away Krishna's friends and his cows. And then Krishna remanifests them exactly like they were before. And when Brahma comes back a year later, which is a moment in his time, he sees, I stole the boys and the calves, but they're still here. How did it happen? And then he has an interaction with Krishna where Krishna reveals to him his unlimited mystic potency, and Brahma feels is dwarfed by that. And then he offers prayers. And actually, they're the most important, perhaps, prayers in the Srimad Bhagavatam that explain the Gaudiya Vaishnava philosophy in the 14th chapter of the 10th canto. Among those prayers, Brahma says, Jnani prayasamudapasya namanta eva jivanti san mukharitam bhavatiyavartam stane stita shuti katam tanuvan manobir ye prayaso jita jito pyasitais trilokyam. Which Brahma is saying, don't depend on your intellect to understand God, because you can't do it. He says, give that up completely. Don't try to understand with your intelligence. He said, rather, stane stita shutigatam, stay whatever position you're in now and hear. Hear submissively the message that comes down from the authoritative source. And from that, he said, you'll advance to the position where you'll have an intimate relationship with God. So, if you go back to the presentation, when I say go back, it's on YouTube, that Radhikaraman Prabhu gave here. At the end of his presentation, I believe it was on Tattva Sandarbha, he goes into an explanation of various philosophies, for instance, Shankar's philosophy and so forth, and then he brings out the Gaudiya philosophy, which brings us to the point of understanding. The intellect brings us to the point of understanding God's inconceivability. And then that's where the intellect leaves off. If we were able to understand God by the intellect, then we'd be God. Because if you can circumscribe something with your intelligence, which is what everyone tries to do in the material world, they want to figure it out. Why? Because they can control it that way. One of the other meanings of Maya, besides illusion, is to count. And it's a kind of illusion also, to count everything. It's like, we gotta measure this. Why? So we can dominate it. And so this idea of understanding God through the intellect ultimately is rejected. It takes us to a certain point, and then we accept the inconceivable nature of the Lord. Atapite deva padam buja dvaya prasada leshana grihita eva hi janati tadvam bhagavan mahimnu nachanya eko picharam vachimban. This is another verse from that chapter, the 14th chapter, 10th canto, where Brahma says, atapite deva padam buja dvaya. He says, if you get a tiny fraction of the mercy, alesha, it just means a whiff, of the mercy of trace of Krishna's mercy, then you can understand him. But if you try intellectually, you'll fail. Prasada leshana grihite janati tatvam bhagavan mahim nachanya eko picharamba jimba. If you try through your intellect, you won't be successful. There was one more, and then we'll move on. There wasn't one more. Okay, good. Yes, all right. Right behind you. That means there's two more. Okay, go ahead.
So I'll just keep it short. I was reading Jaiva Dharma by Bhakti Vinod Thakur, and there was this conversation between a Vaisnava Swami and a student, and the student is asking, is there any application of logic in understanding God?
Mm.
And he Vaisnava Swami said that the only application of logic in understanding God is that you cannot understand God by logic. Then the student asks, is there no other application of logic in the world? Bole, yes, logic has application in the material world, which is relative. And so the logic is relative in nature. So you can apply it in the relative world, which is material world, but cannot understand absolute, which is God.
Yeah. You'll find that one of the definitions of an Uttama Adhikari, that is the topmost position of devotee, is one who can apply logic in explaining the existence of God to others so that they can accept it, because people need a ladder to come up to understand. Was there one more?
Hare Krishna Maharaj. So, I wrote this down. So, I was listening to one of Srila Prabhupada's lecture where he was saying that Krishna has created this material world for giving us opportunity to enjoy, but we will not be happy. That is the condition. So, why he didn't give us the world where we can, where one can be happy and independent?
Well, see, the thing is, going back to logic, if you say, if you present to me like, why can't there be a round square? This is it's just a misuse of the English language. You know, to put a non sequitur together and then say, here, how about this? So the fact is, though, that Krishna gives full facility for everyone, for whatever they want to do. That's why he says in the Bhagavad Gita, if you go through the Gita, you'll see Krishna is very liberal in explaining what's available to us. For instance, yanti deva vrta devan pitrin yanti pratirvata bhutani yanti bhuteja yanti mam yajinopimam. He says you could go wherever you like. Little jiva, you're free to move about the universe or anywhere else for that matter. So it's yanti, deva. You can go to the devas, pratav devan, pitrin. You can go to the pitri planet. Who'd want to do that? I have no idea. Pitrin, yanti, pratirvata, bhutani, yanti, you know. There's all kinds of places in this world. Yasya prabha prabhavato jagananda koti koti shvasheshu vasudari vibhuti binam. Tad Brahma Nishkalam Anantam Ashesha Bhutam Govinda Mari Purusham Tamaham Bhajami. Brahma glorifies Krishna, says, you've made this unlimitedly variegated universe by your energies, and it's really just to facilitate whatever anybody wants. There are places where you can go and in the material world and enjoy without God. There's the Bilva Swarga. That's the, it's actually hell, but it's better than heaven. Does that make any sense? Anybody been to, like, I don't know, Laguna Beach doesn't make it anymore, but there's places people go and it's so nice, they just think like, God, I must be God, or there is no God, who needs him anyway? Everything's nice. There is facility like that. It's described in the fifth canto. The Bilva Swarga is nicer than the kingdom of heaven, which is pretty nice. And nobody has to think about God at all. Just comes at the end when, as Krishna says, that mrityu sarvaharashchahum, finally I'll appear before you as death. It's not our constitutional position to join the material world, and if we do something that's contrary to our nature, then we're going to find the kind of resistance that we're already experiencing here. Okay, yeah, I'm going to move on, so hold that thought, and I want to read to you this poem, as I promised about 2 hours ago, from Sharanagati. It's called Amara Jivana. Sara Papi Rato Nahiko Punyara Lesha. So this is the prayer of somebody who's absorbed in dānya, or utter humility. Now one should not think that, oh, this person is actually like this or very fallen. As Chaitanya Mahaprabhu explains, the symptom of dānya is that even though the person is highly qualified, he thinks himself unqualified. So here's his words. My life is ever given to sin. In it there is not a particle of good. I have caused others great anxiety and have troubled all souls. For the sake of my own enjoyment, I have never hesitated to perform sinful acts. Devoid of all compassion, I am concerned only with my selfish interests. Perpetually speaking lies, I become dejected upon seeing others happy, whereas the misery of others is a source of great delight for me. There are limitless material desires within the core of my heart. I am wrathful, fond of exhibiting arrogance, intoxicated by vanity, and bewildered by worldly affairs. I wear the cherished ornaments of envy and egotism. Ruined by laziness and sleep, I resist all pious deeds, yet I am very enthusiastic to perform wicked deeds. For the sake of worldly fame and reputation, I engage in the practice of deceitfulness. I am victimized by my own greed, being always lustful. A vile, wicked man such as this, rejected by godly people, is a constant offender. Devoid of all good works, forever inclined toward evil, he is worn out and wasted by various miseries. Now in old age, deprived of all means of relief, this humbled and poor Bhaktivinoda submits his tale of grief at the feet of the Supreme Lord. So I want to ask you, how does that make you feel when you hear that? As I'll tell you, the reaction that we had years ago, we used to have programs at our house in Burlingame every week. And somehow or other, I had a copy of this. And we started reading it together in the group at my house. And about, after three sessions of reading it, everybody said, I have to have that. It's the most nectarian thing I've ever heard. Hearing what Dainya feels like in the heart of a great soul. Of course, that's why we called up the author and he said, sorry, it's out of print. If you want it, you have to give us $3,000 and we'll print it. And everybody did. You were there, Dainya. Everyone put forward the money because they wanted it, and we made a printing of this book. And so how did you feel when you heard it? Who said that? Oh, yeah, use the mic.
I saw myself there.
Okay. You related to it personally? Yes, Radhakripa Prabhu.
Whereas when I was hearing it, I was thinking when Acharya is, he's writing like that, then what is me? I mean, just it's inconceivable in my head that at his level, he's like that, then I'm like a million miles below. I don't know how to comprehend that.
Right, so you also related to it and then saw yourself in relationship to him. And yes, Hansapriya.
I remember those days because we end up getting two copies so I don't have to fight with Jananivas.
Oh yeah, that's right, I remember that.
So when you read that, it just made me feel like the taste that Thakur had for that bhajan. And it's a more than humility, it's so much wanting to get closer and serving the Lord. And it just feels like that taste, you know, it's just so overwhelming and contagious and so sweet and joyous that even though if I have no humility or no awareness of what is it, but I want to go see it, what is that he's talking about? What is he tasting? What is he experiencing?
So that was good. That was good. That was what I was hoping for, that effusiveness. You know, it's attractive. Humility, utter humility is attractive. And it does make us want to go actually taste it. What would it taste like to feel like that myself? So the reason I brought up the fact that everybody wanted to read that again and again and again shows there's a taste in that. In fact, those who are, they're not fallen souls, they're descending from the spiritual world to come and assist others, they want to taste it. Therefore, they're entering into that mood of Dainya, of utter humility. Yes.
So I was thinking that generally in the material world, we all try to cover all our shortcomings.
Right.
Like including old age, we'll try to cover.
Yeah.
But he's like bringing out everything one by one.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like, have you ever been in a group setting and then someone just becomes completely vulnerable and just starts revealing like what's wrong, really wrong with their life. I've seen it before. I remember in school sometimes, because sometimes people feel safe in school because they know they're only there for 3 months for the semester and then they'll never see the people again. So it's easier than telling friends and stuff. So they'll be there. And then I just remember one session I was in some class, and then, you know, we were having a discussion and this lady started talking, and I saw everybody sit up like, oh my God, she's actually going to tell the truth here about herself. And it was disarming. It's disarming, you know, this point of it. So you're not trying to cover everything. That's a good point. Actually, we talked about this before. What does sincerity mean? It means that, you know, you don't try to cover it. You just say, like, these are my faults. And paradoxical way, you know, it actually breeds strength. If it's like you have nothing to hide, then you have nothing to lose. That protective covering that I'm always putting up to show that actually I'm better than I actually am is a burden, because, you know, stuff's always falling off, and then you got to put, what, did anybody see that? But if you just, you know, bury yourself before the Supreme Personality of Godhead and the devotees, it's like, I'm doing the best I can. This is what I actually am. This is why the position I'm in. Then it becomes compelling. Okay, so there's a taste to it in Dainya. There's a real taste. In fact, this is the advice, very practical advice we get from Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. He says, Durdaivam Idrishami Hajani Nadrahagaha, which is a response that Mahaprabhu was saying to, like, I'm unfortunate because I don't have a taste for chanting Hare Krishna. Therefore, what to do? And so the next verse he says, just accept this utter humility. And if you do that, then you'll get your taste. So this is one of the practices of devotional service, is to actually cultivate dainya in words and speech and all the ways that we conduct ourselves. So there are various principles that open us, as I began the talk, to receptivity. I remember how Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, after taking sannyas, had brought some followers with him to wander for some time, and he asked them if they brought anything with him, with them, and they said, no, we didn't. You didn't order us to. And he said, good, because I want you to observe how the world's filled up with food and money, and one can receive only as much as is allotted to one by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. I was relating that to the point of receptivity, which means that we receive really according to our position, according to our attitude, according to our receptivity, the way we're open to taking in the gifts. So there's three openings, three ways that one may open oneself, be more receptive, let's say, to Krishna's mercy and to the process of devotional service. So the first one is the opening of humility. It's the principle, the humility principle, which is really being opened to being bereft. There's a kind of defense mechanism where I don't want to admit that I'm bereft. You want to look up bereft so we know what I'm talking about. And I always want to make sure that I'm noted for having intelligence. I'm noted for having the wherewithal to handle any situation. I'm not vulnerable at all. But if I'm bereft, you got a shloka in there, don't you? Oh, because I saw your finger in the book. Okay.
So bereft is an adjective which means deprived of or lacking something, especially a non-material asset.
Ooh.
origin is late 16th century, the archaic participle of bereave. And bereave, the origin of the word bereave is coming from bereafian, Old English, bereafian, which means to be deprived of a loved one through profound absence, especially due to one's death.
Okay, it sounds like separation from Krishna or something. So here's just, if we look at Chaitanya Charitamrita Madhya 16, 263 and 64. This verse I caught my attention recently because when I was looking at the principle of humility, I noticed that this is the main way that in which Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was attracted to various devotees based on their humility. That's again Chaitanya Charitamrita Madhya 16.263. Are you all taking all this in over here? Any thoughts? Okay, I'll get back to you in a minute. Okay, so this verse, if we look at the translation, please, says, this is Chaitanya Mahaprabhu speaking. He says, indeed, the humility of these two brothers could even melt stone. He's talking about Rupa and Sanatan Goswami. Because I was very pleased with their behavior, I told them, although you are both very much exalted, you consider yourselves inferior, and because of this, Krishna will very soon deliver you. Here's Prabhupada's purport. Such are the qualifications of a pure devotee. Materially, one may be very opulent, experienced, influential, and educated, but if one still thinks himself lower than straw in the street, one attracts the attention of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu or Lord Krishna. Although Maharaj Prataparuja was a king, he took up a broom to cleanse the road for Lord Jagannath's rat chariot. Because of this humble service, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was very pleased with the king. And for that reason, the Lord embraced him. According to Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's instructions, a devotee should never be puffed up by material power. He should know that material power is the result of one's past good activities, karma, and is consequently transient. At any moment, all of one's material opulence can be finished. That's a good point to remember. Everything's... we've borrowed everything. Can be finished at any time. So it's actually comical when somebody has material opulence and then flaunts it and becomes conceited because of it. He is always meek and humble, always humble and meek, considering himself lower than a piece of straw. Because of this, the devotees are eligible to return home back to Godhead. So this is an eligibility for advanced spiritual life. And it makes one able to receive, that's what receptivity means, Krishna's mercy. Any other opposite emotion to humility is the way in which we block the actual flow of mercy coming from Krishna. So there are various phrases that I was thinking about that come up, which express my feeling that I already have something. So one of them, which we've talked about before, is I know that. I already know that. And I did meet a man once when we were going door to door in Sunnyvale who said, I know everything. And I invited all the devotees who were nearby. I had to have them come meet him because... Actually, he was in his bathrobe. He came out that door and he looked at Bhagavad Gita. He goes, I know that. I know everything. I was like, wow. So we all came to meet him. And another one was, I'm already. Say, I'm already. And then there's many blanks you could fill in. I'm already this or that. What are some ways to fill in the blanks? I'm already doing this. That's something I hear a lot. I'm already an expert. I'm already doing this. I already know that. That this already means that I'm not open. I'm not receptive. So one should be open to being bereft. I mean, think about it. If you just let yourself be without any asset, then it opens you to the mercy of Krishna. So it also... humility means that you can be a perpetual student of life. You can't learn unless you're humble. And this is one of the principles that Krishna puts forward in the Bhagavad Gita in the 13th chapter, 8th verse. Manitvam Adambitvam. So he says humility and pridelessness are the first elements for getting proper knowledge. You have to be humble. So if you're humble, it means you're open at all time to learn a lesson, and you can perpetually learn. The fact that life becomes a school for you. And this, the principle that is put forward in the Bhagavatam is summarized in one word, which is akinchana, which I don't have anything. So kinchana means something, and akinchana means I don't have anything. I'm akinchana. And it comes up again and again, that principle. So the idea of starting at empty every day, that I don't have anything, and I'm starting over with nothing, I'm akinchana, opens you to the, as mentioned in the Bhagavatam, Krishna's akinchana vitaya, which means he's the property of the materially impoverished. So you become Krishna's property if you declare yourself akinchana. Krishna is also known as akinchana gochara, and the one who's easily approached by the person who's bereft of all material acquisitions. And akinchana also means, especially as mentioned in the verse 5.8.12, that sarvasya, how does that go? Yes, yes, bhaktir bhagavati akinchana sarvar gunas tatra samasati sura harava bhaktasya kuto mahat guna manoratenasati davato bihi. So the verse says that somebody who is akinchana, who's performing akinchana bhakti, means you're doing it with no material motive, is opens him or herself to all the good qualities. They all start flowing into your life, all the good qualities, if you're akinchana. Yes, 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 bhaktir bhagavati, bhagavati akinchana. So you're doing bhagavati akinchana. You're doing devotional service without any material motivation. Only service for service. Your goal is to serve Krishna and the devotees with no motivation. Then the verse goes on to say that you'll be infused with the qualities of the devas. Or as our acharyas put it, you'll have such high qualification from being akinchana that the devas will want to come and live with you, because they'll consider you to be the most advanced person. So those who are akinchana, they start on empty. They feel themselves bereft. They start over on empty every day and say, I don't have anything. They open themselves to these gem-like qualities that are available to people who are like that. What do you think so far? Are you buying this? Okay. So, Prabhupada again says akinchana means kinchana means something of this material world, and akinchana means not something in this material world. So that means that I don't depend on anything material. That is inherent in the qualities of considering that Krishna is my protector and he's my maintainer, and that I'm akinchana. I'm only fully dependent on him in all different ways. So that is the akinchana principle. So you can keep that principle in your life, the akinchana principle. And the next aspect of this humility, when one is humble, then he can also be hungry. Because if you're not full of yourself, which is Krishna's admonition in the 15th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, where he says, Nirmana moha jita sanga dosha. His first recommendation for those who are on the spiritual path is nirmana. Don't be mana, which means thinking that I'm really the center of everything and I'm really special. Nirmana. Or as we say, you're the man, so don't be the man. Like I'm not the man. So the point here is, if you're like that, you can remain hungry. Ayurveda says that real health is digestive power. If you have strong digestion, then it means all the other systems in your body are working properly. And similarly, when you have this humility, then you're hungry because you're empty. You're open for more to come in. And this is spiritual health also. Real spiritual health means to be really hungry, that you want to hear more, and you're open to Krishna's mercy coming from any direction. This is the way in which a devotee is conducting him or herself 24 hours a day, is expecting Krishna's mercy, because he or she is hungry. Tate anukampam susamikshamano means that they're always ready to take in Krishna's mercy from any direction. Tate anukampam susamikshamano. They're expectant of that because they're hungry. They have an appetite. And also, you know, when you have a strong appetite, you get, you'll be kind of greedy for something to eat when it comes. So this is the idea in devotional service. It should be like that, that you're really hungry for it. You're like you're starving to hear about Krishna. This is described in various ways. One of the ways is by Rupa Goswami, who says, Krishna bhakti rasa bhavito mati kriyatam yadi kritopi labhyate tatalalyam api mulyam ekalam janmakoti sukritina labhyate. He says you can't get bhakti by doing all kinds of pious work in this world. The only way you can get it is if you're really hungry for it. You have to want it more than anything else. That matches up nicely with food, because when you're really hungry, you don't care about anything else. You want to hear some nice music? No. You want $100? No. Do you want to go see the sunset? No. I want to eat. I'm only interested in eating. So this hunger, it's got laulium. It means I don't want anything else. I just want this, and I'm starving for it. So the intensity of that desire to hear about Krishna is synonymous with our spiritual health. Jiva Goswami says there's a one-to-one relationship. The hungrier you are to hear, the more advanced you are in devotional service, period. It's also said by Kapila Dev. What's my verse, please? Kapila Dev says, no, that's a verse, but that's not the verse. Please, give me the verse, look it up. Kapila Dev, third canto. He mentions that that the symptom of the person who is performing devotional service, which is above the three modes of material nature, huh? Madguna shruti matrina mai sarva gohashe manogatir avichina yata gangam maso buddhao. Next line. This is horrible. What? So first, the first one, while you're looking it up, can you find it, please? Madguna Shruti Matrina. Look in the back index and see if you can find it. Madguna Shruti Matrina. Mai sarva gahashai manogatir avichina yata gangam basom budao. So this first four lines say that this is what devotional service is like once you pass the influence of the three modes of material nature. And that means that your mind becomes naturally attracted to hearing about Krishna. The way that the Ganges is unstoppable. It flows down to the sea without any hindrance. If you try to block it, it'll go around over, it'll burst through at some time. It has that force. So in a similar way, the mind of somebody who's advanced in devotional service and is now free from the influences of the modes of nature is attracted naturally to hearing about Krishna and is hungry for it, hungry, hungry all the time. Next line. Lakshanam bhakti yogasya nirgunasya hyudaritam ahaituki avyavahita yab bhakti purushottame. Thank you very much, and thank you. So the last part, lakshanam, means the qualities, bhakti yogasya. So the quality of devotional service is three, freed from the modes of material nature. This is pure now. Lakshanam bhakti yogasya, nirgunasya, it's not affected by the modes, hyudaritam. Haituki, it's causeless. It's coming from spontaneity within the heart. It's like, it's natural. It's natural, spontaneous devotional service. And avyavihita means it doesn't stop. There's nothing where you run into a blockade and you say, okay, that's it, I quit. I'm taking a break. There's no break. It's 24 hours a day, constant. Avyavihita. And so, ahaituki avya bhakti purushottami. So this is what devotional service is. This hunger, this extreme hunger. And for those who cultivate this principle of the humility principle, they empty themselves, their akinchana, and they develop this extreme hunger for hearing about Krishna, for doing devotional service, then they can enter into the devotional service proper, means real practice of bhakti 24 hours a day. So be hungry and humble. That is real health in spiritual life when you're hungry for it. The next principle of being open, be open to experts. Be open to those who are more advanced than yourself, because mercy flows down and so does knowledge. That's why Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, something that oftentimes is counterintuitive to those who are who consider themselves highly learned, as an example. And that is that tadvidi pranipatina priprashnina sevaya uparakshanti de jnanam jnaninas tattvadarshina. Shocking thing. If you want to know something, approach somebody who's advanced and expert. And then be really humble. Serve that person and inquire from the person and let them be the smart one. Let them actually be that. Because the ego gets in the way. When I'm not humble, it's really hard to learn anything from anybody. Because one thing is you can listen to somebody and then think, like, who do they think they are? Like, they just got here. Why do they think they have anything to say? I mean, can you learn from somebody who's not senior to you? Only if you're humble. In fact, you could learn from, you know, the person on the street. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, when he saw this, he was standing at the Garuda Stambha at the Jagannath Temple, and he was just absorbed in the darshan of Lord Jagannath, and it was crowded in there. So then this lady runs in, and she climbs up the Garuda Stambha, and she puts one foot on Mahaprabhu's shoulder and the other foot on the Garuda Stambha. Is that a good idea? Pop quiz. Well, Govinda, Mahaprabhu's servant, who's supposed to protect his body and watch out for him, he saw this happen. It happened in a second. And you'll know, like, I was at Varshana once, and the doors opened, and I got smashed. And it actually felt good, because when I picked myself off the floor, I was thinking, wow, maybe I got a little bhakti going on here. They were like, So Govinda looked over, saw the woman. The woman didn't even realize what she had done. It was so spontaneous. And he said, get down. And she gets down. And then Mahaprabhu looked and saw what happened. And he chastised Govinda and said, Govinda, you're an uncivilized person. You don't know what you're talking about. I wish I had that kind of enthusiasm this woman has. In other words, you know, those who are in this principle, living in this principle, appreciating expertise, bhakti, advancement, wherever it is, they can take from there and they can make advancement themselves. So, you know, the quotation from Voltaire, appreciation is a wonderful thing. It makes what is excellent in others belong to us as well. Please repeat. Appreciation is a wonderful thing. It makes what is excellent in others belong to us as well. Let's ask our pundit circle what that means, why that's true. We haven't heard a peep out of them yet. Why is that true? Don't have a stampede for the microphone.
Said,
just pontificate. Go ahead.
Why is it true? Or
yeah. What do you think that means? Like, what's this? What is the? I mean, how does that work? If you appreciate somebody else, he's saying. Listen to this. He's saying that if you appreciate someone else, then whatever's excellent in them that you're appreciating, it comes into you. So have you ever? Let's just start with. Has that ever happened to you? Like, you appreciate something expert in somebody else, and then. Like it opens to you. Okay, go ahead, Gita Priya. And then we got Vrindavan.
This may work because...
Uh-oh, like, we can barely hear you for some reason.
This could work because, you know, if you, like, you know, tell them or appreciate what their... or appreciate their qualities, they may appreciate yours and...
Let's get a mutual appreciation club. Vrindavan, what were you going to say? And then we'll go back to...
I think it was related with, like, inspiring, because when you appreciate, like...
Hold it close.
When you appreciate, like, what they're doing, you get inspired and try to do what they're doing.
Okay.
I've actually heard the exact opposite. Like, if you notice the bad qualities of someone, you'll get those bad qualities. So I guess it goes for the opposite, saying when you appreciate...
Yeah, it's kind of mystical, right?
Yeah, when you appreciate...
These things are flowing through us in different ways. You had some idea there, I could tell. Go ahead. And then Bart's got something.
I was going to say, like, some people say, like, your association reflects on your your personality.
Yeah, it definitely has to do with association. And, you know, how we associate with people makes a huge difference. You can associate with somebody who's an expert, who's highly advanced, and then close yourself off to whatever they have to say just by thinking, like, I got nothing to learn from this person. Because why is he talking and not me? That could happen, right?
Okay. This is kind of similar to Vrindavan's point, but I was thinking that, like, since you're appreciating something that they're doing, you're, like, observing them while doing it, and since you want to be, like, you appreciate those qualities, then you're trying to pick up those qualities yourself.
Yeah, it's kind of scientific, too, what you're saying. I mean, you could even, like, if you're appreciating, you're probably more attentive also. Yes.
I just adding on to Bart's point, I just thought that this meant if you're aware of if you have enough awareness to appreciate someone and glorify their qualities, then the courage to say that, then if you've understood that person to that extent, then you can also learn from that and become yourself.
Nice assist. So this is poetically pointed out. One of my godbrothers, Bhuri Jean Prabhu, once said that he put it like this. He said that the contents of the heart of that person, if you appreciate that, it opens their heart and the contents flow out to you. So there's a way, everybody's a container. The great souls, they contain great qualities. And to avail yourself of those qualities, you serve. It means that active appreciation means you render some service. And then ask relevant questions, and also be very submissive before the person, because also just the way nature works, the flow of water, as an example, comes down. If you're in a room and there's some people more advanced and some people less advanced, somebody might then declare, well, let's just say we're all equal and move on from there. Ever been in one of those? Then basically what you have is a situation where you're not going to learn from anybody that's more advanced than you. So this is a principle to appreciate the experts. And the third opening, a way to stay open, is to be open to failure. Because, as Prabhupada used to say, one of my favorite phrases, failure is the pillar to success. And if you're willing to fail, which you're guaranteed to do, if you take a risk, then then those moments of sincere failure, that is, you're trying your best and doing whatever you can, and then there's some kind of mistake or reversal, something doesn't go well, it is a learning experience. In fact, those can be the times, and often are, or most likely are the times at which we learn the most, because we may be very humble at that time, and also experiencing this what we call teachable moment. I'm actually open now because I've lost my false prestige, I've made the mistake, and now I'm open to learning. And so in the process of devotional service, I was listening to Prabhupada speak this morning, and he said that when you begin, it was a lecture on the nectar of devotion, he said that when you begin, there'll be all kinds of difficulties because of the faults that one carries within one's own heart, and therefore there'll be mistakes. Said, but we can't become discouraged by those. We have to see that they become the pillars of success. And of course, in modern conventional wisdom, even the biggest advertising agency in America, who started the Nike commercial and all that, has a huge poster in their lobby that says, fail harder. And of course, people say, fail forward fast. And those who are progressive know this principle, that you have to be open to failure, taking risks, and moving forward, despite the fact that you know that you're going to make mistakes. So these are the three openings that I'm suggesting. The first is the humility principle. And the second one is be open to experts. And the third is be open to failure. Three. So now we'll take some reflections on any of the openings. Yes.
So I was just reminded of Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya.
Is that on?
Yeah.
Okay.
Is it okay? Yeah. So I was, because you talked about receptivity, so when Mahaprabhu went, he became unconscious in Jagannath Puri, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya brought him to his home. He was attracted to his beauty and everything, but somehow he could not still receive the mercy, and he wanted to teach him Vedanta philosophy, and he wanted even to... Get him, you know, sannyas initiation from a bigger sampradaya, because he still did not consider him the experts, and even I think Gopinath Acharya and everyone tried to correct him, but he did not receive. And then Gopinath Acharya tells him that's only because you don't have mercy of the Lord, and only just by scholarship you cannot understand God. And then later, you know, with all that exercise of when Mahaprabhu, you know, explains to him, and later he was totally transformed and. Yeah, I was just remembering.
What a good example. Such a nice example you gave. You know, Mahaprabhu came to Jagannath Puri. He was a 24-year-old sannyasi. And here's Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, who's elderly, and who's known as the greatest scholar in India. And now he meets this young sannyasi and proposes that I'll elevate you to a higher level of sannyas. I'll also teach you about Vedanta Sutra. So Mahaprabhu sits with him for 7 days and just listens and doesn't say a word. And, you know, that has a powerful effect, that kind of humility. And, of course, he exhibited his own learning in the course of the conversation. That's what started to attract the mind of Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. But he did it in such a gentle way that Sarvabhauma was really open for it. He did a similar thing to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu with Prakashananda Saraswati. As Prabhupada mentions, when he first came to meet Prakashananda and all the Mayavadi sannyasis in Benares, he went into the assembly and he sat in like the lowest place he could find, like right around where people were washing their feet and stuff. That's, you know, you come into rooms like, where's my seat? You know, but Mahaprabhu came in and is like, where's the lowest place I can sit? And that really, I mean, humility is powerful. it's not something that you can go and buy at Walmart or something, because it's an intangible, but it has an immense force. When somebody actually exhibits humility, it's compelling. People are drawn to it. And Prakashananda was so drawn to it that he reached out his hand and he said, no, please, come sit in this place, the elevated place. Prabhupada mentions there that that was when Prakashananda got qualification to actually understand what Mahaprabhu was about to say as he rendered service. So that was the way that Mahaprabhu entered the hearts of the devotees, or the Mayavadis, soon-to-be devotees, through that powerful humility, or the power of humility. Yeah. So the overarching theme of what I'm talking about here is receptivity. I've pointed out that we, as living beings, especially in human form here, we have a certain capacity to receive. And really, advancement in human life means to increase that receptivity. Therefore, I've mentioned three places where we should be open. We should be open to being humble, and there's really good reasons why we should be humble if we examine it. And also, I've presented some of the benefits of being humble. They're innumerable, so why not keep that as an opening? And I also recommended being open, wide open to experts, those who already have knowledge or qualities that we're interested in, and being really open to them. We can use the process that Krishna recommends in the Bhagavad Gita to have a service mind towards them, to listen very carefully, and listen submissively. It means not thinking, why this person, why aren't I speaking? And I hope it's not that good what they say, because that will make me look bad, or something like that. There's all these various psychologies that will block us from actually taking in the benefits, the qualities that somebody who's advanced has. So be open there. And the third opening? Be open to fail, because you're going to fail anyway. But take it as a teachable moment, you're failing, and learn from it to move forward. Three openings. So, yes, Gita Pri is on a roll. Please keep going.
I just like the point, like, be open to failure, because a lot of the times you can't just do something right on the first time. You're going to try and you're going to fail and then you're going to do it again. And, like, each time you fail, you know, you, like, learn from your failure and try not to do that the next time. So it just kind of...
Anything specific you can share with us?
Oh, I just liked it because of how...
No, I mean, in your life, anywhere you failed and then you found that actually that helped you in some way.
Actually, I was playing badminton with my dad.
Yeah.
And, so, like... I kind of was serving wrong, so, like, each time I served wrong, he would tell me to do something right, and then I would do it wrong, but I know what I was doing wrong, so now it's easier for me to serve.
Okay, good. That's a good example. Somebody else? I wanted to point out something about receptivity that I thought about that sort of proves the theory of receptivity, at least anecdotally. And this is an article that I found about lottery winners, of all people. And this article says, after winning the biggest undivided jackpot lottery in U.S. history, Mavis L. Wanchek of Chicopee, Massachusetts, ignored much of the advice that financial experts typically give to lottery winners. She quit her job, spoke with the press, and took her winnings as a lump sum. While she may be able to afford to break the rules, most winners can't. Lottery winners are more likely to declare bankruptcy within 3 to 5 years than the average American. What's more, studies have shown that winning the lottery does not necessarily make you happier or healthier. Evidence shows that most people who make it to the top 1% of income earners usually don't stay at the top for very long. writes Washington Post Jonelle Marte. Economist Jay Zogarski agrees with the research. He writes for U.S. News and World Report, studies found that instead of getting people out of financial trouble, winning the lottery got people into more trouble. Since bankruptcy rates soared for lottery winners 3 to 5 years after winning. Jack Whitaker, who won $315 million in a lottery in West Virginia in 2002, tells Time, I wish that we had torn the ticket up. Since winning, Whitaker's daughter and granddaughter died due to drug overdoses. Just 8 months after winning, he was robbed of $545,000. I just don't like Jack Whitaker. I don't like the hard heart I've got. He's talking about himself. He said, I don't like what I've become. There's more. Hold on. He is the last person I would have prototyped for going completely crazy, but he did. Don McNay, a financial consultant to lottery winners and the author of Life Lessons from the Lottery, tells Time about Whitaker. No question it was because he won the lottery. McNay says many winners struggle with suicide, depression, and divorce. It's the curse of the lottery because it made their lives worse instead of improving them, he said. Another major struggle that winners often face is saying no to friends and family who hope to join in on the good fortune. Hey, remember me? Charles Conrad, senior financial planner of Zarka Financial, told Teresa Dixon Murray, once family members and friends learn of the windfall, they have expectations of what they should be entitled to, he explained. It can be very difficult to say no. There are a multitude of studies, in fact, books that go into the details of what happens to people. The reason I found this to helpful in understanding the principles of receptivity is that if you're not receptive, for instance, just in this context of having a certain amount of money, you won't be able to absorb it or manage it. It will just interfere with the normal course of your life. And in any given circumstance, we have to actually be receptive. Be able to receive, that means, to take something. That's what the word receive means. It comes from Latin. It means to retake something. And unless we have the qualities and the qualification to take it, then we won't be able to get it. No matter, it may be in the environment, but you can't get it. It may be right in front of you, but you can't get it. It may be given to you through a windfall, through winning the lottery, but you still can't get it. Even though they gave it to you, you can't take it. You can't receive it. So you have to develop by being open to receiving. And these are age-old principles for actually being open, which is the three principles that I discussed. We have time for just a few more reflections. Yes.
So, Maharaj, before I go to the one on the internet, I was just following the story that you just told about Mavis on the internet.
Yeah, Mavis.
Yeah. And so the store owner from where she purchased the lottery, he obviously knew how to receive because he said that he will donate the 50,000 fries that he receives because of selling the tickets to children's charities.
It's a children's charity. Yeah.
So what a contrast.
I mean, was that it?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
No,
there's more.
Back on Nike. Oh, internet, that's, yeah, others.
No. There's more on the internet?
No.
No, okay. Other reflections?
Yeah, there's one on the internet from Vaikuntha Nayak.
Okay, for Vaikuntha Nayak, yeah. Yes.
So he has two, actually. So first is that I'm having difficulty understanding how Bhakti Vinod Thakur describes himself. Maybe I'm trying to understand through logic, and it's inconceivable. Can you please advise how this feeling is different from self-abnegation?
Yeah, there's an old saying that it's about not of thinking less of yourself, but thinking of yourself less. Of course, that's from Alice in Wonderland. But the difference between, and this distinction is made in various places, among them the Brihat Bhagavatamrita, Narada Muni says that dainya might be, or this utter humility, how could it be distinguished from someone who's just really poor or lazy or has low self-esteem? And he says it's diametrically different. That the person who's experiencing dhyana is full of happiness, actually. Although it seems counterintuitive that somebody who's feeling lowly like this would be feeling bliss. That's actually the case. And they actually become more and more expert and enlivened by that feeling, the stimulation from feeling that humility. Whereas somebody who has low self-esteem is actually self-centered, and they're just disturbed that they're not in the center, and they can't be. And therefore they become disempowered and ineffectual in the way they work and move in the world because of taking on the philosophy of the victim, that I'm a victim of my circumstances. And so the difference is profound, actually. Was there another question? Okay.
I have read one definition of humility: not having an agenda of one's own, rather following the agenda of the spiritual master and Krishna. Is this correct understanding?
That is correct understanding, because if you look at Arjuna, Prabhupada poses the question, was he being humble by going out on the battlefield and shooting arrows through the hearts of many people? You know, how does that match with the idea of humility to the man on the street in Silicon Valley, who often recoils when you talk about humility because he or she will say, how am I going to get by in the corporate environment if I'm humble? So Arjuna is more of a match for such persons because in his demonstration of humility, because humility actually means to take Krishna's agenda as the main agenda, not my own. As an example, in the beginning of Bhagavad Gita, he had his own agenda. He said, yeah, but what about my family? And what about the way this is going to make me look? And what am I going to get out of this afterwards? And Krishna said it after Arjuna surrendered. He pointed out to him that you should just work for me, actually, and don't worry about the result. And that's what means to take Krishna's agenda. Do thou fight for the sake of fighting. Okay, there's a couple more in the back. Pass back the mic, please. If you have one in the back, raise your hand. You had a question. Yeah. Raise your hand. Hare Krishna.
Sorry about that. Hare Krishna. So I was just wondering, in the context of...
A little closer.
Oh, sorry. Is this okay?
Yes.
Oh, great. So just in the context of Krishna consciousness, I was wondering what's the difference between insecurity and humility? Because I feel like there's a fine line, and
well,
it's hard.
Kind of what I was just saying. Uh-huh. You know, insecurity is a material emotion based on, I think I'm my body, mm-hmm. and I'm also worried that I'm going to lose my position.
Yeah.
Right? That's material insecurity.
Right.
One who is extremely humble is not feeling insecure mm-hmm. or fearful mm-hmm. because he or she is taking shelter of Krishna mm-hmm. and therefore feels very protected. And the result is different. The person who is insecure is worried, perhaps, ineffectual in different ways. But a person who has this extreme humility, you'll find is steady in his or her duty mm-hmm. and the performance of devotional service and so forth. Because such a person is not affected by external circumstances as much, because he or she is depending on Krishna and not on his or her own prowess. That's the difference. And it's a really good question. Thanks for bringing that up. Yes, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 5. Okay, we got 6 minutes, so make the questions concise, and I'll try to make the answers concise also. Look at that sharing. Isn't that nice?
Thank you. What does it feel like to receive the grace of God?
Well, this is the subject matter of the Sharanagati. Part of it is experiencing this sense of humility, because there's no time at which one can feel qualified to accept it. In other words, in tasting even a tiny molecule of mercy coming from God, one sees that it's unlimited, and that bhakti is so magnificent and beyond, you know, what I can comprehend, that one feels extremely overwhelmed, or just overwhelmed. You don't need extremely and overwhelmed. Overwhelmed by the situation, and one of the emotions is intense gratitude. And there are symptoms mentioned in very specific terms throughout the teachings of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu that one develops when one's heart is melting because of that gratitude for receiving God's grace. So some of the symptoms he mentions, one, he says, Shantir Avyarta Kalatram. So first, Shantir means forgiveness. This is actually, forgiveness is a combination of two things. One is called this dānya, or extreme humility, and dāya. Well, dāya means compassion towards other living beings. And when one feels extreme humility and then sees himself or herself in relationship to other living beings, one feels that I should forgive others, because who am I to condescend or think that I have a greater position than them? So shantir, avyarta kalatvam, means that one doesn't want to waste even a second, because one sees that the at every moment God's grace is available, and I don't want to waste even one molecule. I mean, you see this in the material world. Like, if you see somebody who's addicted to heroin, they are meticulous about saving every aspect of the drug. Like addicts that, you know, they go out of their way to like make sure that they don't lose one speck of the precious powder that they want to inject. And this is the material absorption. On the other side, you would see somebody who's experiencing the grace of God. They're so addicted to it that they don't want to waste any time at any moment, because they realize that I could be losing the greatest gift. So they use all their time. And the third part, there's nine of them, I'll only mention three for now, but the third one is that one becomes naturally uninterested in inferior activities, those that are not related to God, that they're just not interesting anymore. Those are three symptoms.
Hare Krishna. Thank you so much for a helpful lecture. I was reminded of one of your mantras, I live to be corrected.
Yes.
And my initial understanding of that mantra was in relation to receiving feedback, but I think this also expands because it's covering all the three principles of receptivity. I live to be corrected can reflect a humble attitude, openness to learn, and also acceptance of failure. So,
You just made my whole day by saying that it was helpful. When you said it was helpful, I thought, okay, well, I'm happy now. Thank you.
I have a small question.
Yes, please. Go ahead. You have 30 seconds.
You said reception means to be able to receive.
So yes.
If I'm not open to receiving something, then that means I am resistant to something. So can I take...
It depends what it is. We want to be receptive to the right things.
Okay.
So when we're talking about receptivity, when you're tuning a radio, then yeah. You want to be receiving the right frequency. So it's not that we want to be receptive to anyone and everything.
Right.
We're very, very selective, in fact. And so we want to be tuned in. And that's why Krishna goes to the trouble of mentioning in the Bhagavad Gita there are lower and higher energies. Be interested in the refined life of bhakti. Take in that which is most beneficial and leave the rest. So yeah, tune into the right channel. OMG, 20 seconds right behind you. Go ahead. We'll try for it.
Yeah, I don't have any question, Hare Krishna.
Okay.
I just want to make quick comment.
Hey, good to see you again.
Yeah, thanks. Same here. So we used to recite this Krishnashtakam in my childhood, right? And this comment is about the receptivity.
Yes.
So one of the things written in the glory of Lord Krishna himself is, Dine Dine Navam Navam, namami nanda sambhavam. So he's like dine dine, he himself is new every day.
We can always count on you to end the class with a flourish, something nectarian that you got.
Yes, I mean, this is, I mean, out of all Krishnashtakam lines, this somehow just stuck in
that
my mind.
That stuck with you.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's very sweet. Yeah. It opened our receptors definitely to Krishna's mercy. So we all came together, we talked about Krishna and some ideas about how to take in his mercy. And we thank everyone for joining us online. Everyone say Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
And thanks for coming into live studios here at ISKCON of Silicon Valley. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Natari Armarman, Natari Armarman, hey, Natari Armarman, Natari Armarman, Natari Armarman, Natari Armarman.